Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Ingmar Bergman, The Cinema of the Soul. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 15 minutes. Ingmar Bergman. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World. We have walked through suspense that calibrates your nerves and storms that carve meaning into landscape. Now we step into a chamber where a lamp is turned down, a chair is pulled forward by half a foot, and a face takes the entire weight of a story. Ingmar Bergman, born in 1918 to a pastor and a mother who carried silence like an instrument, made the cinema a room where the most private questions dared to speak aloud. He treated the close-up as a sacrament and the rehearsal as a moral education. He turned actors into partners, light into doctrine, and doubt into a discipline. If he is sometimes caricatured as the poet of gloom, it is because people remember the mask and forget the warmth of the hand that held it. He changed how we see the world by changing how we see a face, and by insisting that the space between two faces is where meaning takes its first breath. He grew up in Uppsala and Stockholm in apartments where the day was divided by punctual prayer and by rules that felt as architectural as walls. He learned how confession sounds when it is imposed and how grace sounds when it arrives by surprise. As a boy, he traded a sibling's comfort for a magic lantern and discovered to his embarrassment that light can persuade without permission. He stole time from school to haunt theaters. He drew scenery and moved chairs. He watched directors teach a company what a play could be. He learned from Strindberg that a stage can be a crucible, and from Molière that a joke can contain an X-ray. That apprenticeship, church, theater, light, never left him. When he made films, he behaved like a stage director who had finally been handed a microscope and told, without sarcasm, to go ahead and use it. His 1940s work, Crisis, It Rains on Our Love, Port of Call, already wants to strip away ceremony and watch the ordinary struggle with guilt. You can see the theater's furniture in the frames. You can see the new appetite for faces and the patience of the edit. The 1950s break open. Summer with Monica discovers the camera's appetite for skin and for consequence. Sawdust and Tinsel finds humiliation in a circus ring and refuses to smile it away. Smiles of a summer nighting knots sex and pride with such elegance that American censors cleared their throats and Broadway learned a new word, a little night music. The same man who would later make Winter Light could also choreograph flirtation like a better track's dice. In The Seventh Seal, he put a knight on a Scandinavian beach with death dressed like a parish sacristan and played chess for time. Less a theology than a courtesy extended to terror itself, a promise to listen before we are taken. The film's bravura, its skeletal standard and its dance on the ridge, conceals its humility. A traveling troupe, bread shared, a family rescued for a night, a jug of milk treated as policy. The other key, more decisive than any single set piece, is his discovery of Faro, a low island in the Baltic scraped by wind and light into plains that a camera can read like scripture. He found it in the late 1950s and built a life there. Wooden houses, rooms with white curtains and plain tables, a barn converted into a studio, a theater next door to a kitchen. He wrote in notebooks first thing in the morning. He rehearsed like a tailor, measure twice, cut once, then let the cloth settle. Faro gave him a geography that suited the way he wanted to work, a small place for deep attention, an unornamented horizon, weather that refused to flatter. You can feel it in through a glass darkly, persona, hour of the wolf, shame, scenes from a marriage, not only as exterior but as a temperature he carried into rooms. People speak of his faith trilogy as if it were a catechism. Through a glass darkly, Winter Light, The Silence are less a tract than a sequence of experiments. Three rooms in which people try, in different registers, to stay honest when God does not answer. In the first, a young woman's psychosis reads scripture out loud by accident. A father watches and fails to love well. A brother and husband practice a courage that bites their fingers. A spider god appears because fear has to wear a shape before it can be endured. In the second, a pastor in a snow-lit church finds that his prayers return to him unspent. A woman who loves him tells him the truth in a letter written like a subpoena. A fisherman who comes for help leaves with less. In the third, language itself fails. Two sisters travel to a foreign city whose words do not translate. A child becomes the only intact conscience in a room full of adults busy with their self-inventions. The lighting is a doctrine. Gunnar Fischer first, then Sven Nykvist, poured illumination like milk where needed and starved it where honesty required austerity. Fisher gave the earlier films their crisp theatricality. Nyquist gave the later ones their breathing skin. He learned the close-up with Fisher and then deepened it with Nyquist into something you could almost mistake for a separate art. To watch a face in a Bergman film is to learn that a pore can carry more information than a speech. The camera sits close without peeping, the lens a normal focal length so that proportion remains trustworthy, the exposure a sea level that doesn't swamp a wrinkle. He disliked pretty, he treasured exact. Liv Ullmann's face across the decade from Persona through Cries and Whispers and Autumn Sonata to Saraban becomes for him what a coastline is to a geographer. A map you can revisit and a record of weather. B.B. Anderson, Harriet Anderson, Ingrid Thulin, Gunnel Lindblom, playwrights in their own right when given that lens. Max von Sydow and Gunnar Bjornstrand carry the male ledger. Arrogance, devotion, exhaustion, cruelty, tenderness, competence. Each catalogued with the rigor of a clerk and the compassion of a forgiving neighbor. When he wants the camera to confess that the apparatus itself is a participant, he does not preach, he commits theater. In Persona, a nurse and an actress share a clinic. The actress goes silent. The nurse talks, then talks too much, then cannot stop. A blistered film strip tears and burns mid-reel. Later, two faces are pressed together in the light until they become a new face. You feel the mind attempting to make one story from two and failing because truth is not a collage. It is one of the few films in which cinema remembers to show its own body. The famous dissolve of faces is less a trick than a courtesy. It admits that the boundary between self and other is negotiable and that the negotiation can wound. Hour of the Wolf makes portraits into demons not because demons are entertaining but because an artist knows that faces he cannot forget will eventually organize his fear. Shame, made under a sky that refuses to clarify which side owns the right to speak, turns a couple's home into a ruin and then into a stage for a different war. The quarrel that punishment produces between two people who had believed themselves decent. Cries and Whispers fills a house with red. Not a painter's thrill but a blood-warm wall against which grief cannot hide. He and Nyquist let the color sit like a drum under dialogue. The women in that house attempt to behave. Their behavior collapses at intervals with a grandeur that is only the truth of fatigue. The theater kept him honest. He ran companies. He directed Strindberg and Ibsen and Molière and Shakespeare. He watched rehearsal carve out an evening's soul. He understood pace better than most directors understand plot. When television arrived as an instrument for extended time, he recognized a theater director's gift, hours to let a relationship show its seasons. Scenes from A Marriage aired in six parts and altered domestic calendars in more than one country. Marriages broke, marriages strengthened, therapists acquired new clients, politicians fumed, sales of bedroom furniture dipped, according to gossip. The work itself is not a mercenary. It is a laboratory. Two people, played by Liv Ullmann and Erland Josephson, invent and dismantle a life. Episodes arrive like returning weather. The lighting refuses to flatter. The dialogue refuses to decorate. The camera accepts that the most important moment in a scene is the place where neither person can think of anything to say. Years later, Saraband returned to these characters like a late letter that arrives with the morning's bread. The prose is plainer. The faces are more transparent. The pain is cleaned of exhibition. What he did with sound is as decisive as what he did with light. He liked rooms that breathe. He liked the sound of a stove. He liked the way footsteps on old floors tell you something about a house's economy. He liked silence that is not vacuum but air. He kept music out of scenes that are tempted to use it as glue. When music arrives, it is a visitor, not a carpet. Bach in Persona like a mercy a room does not deserve. Chopin in Cries and Whispers not as perfume but as a handkerchief. An organ in Winter Light that insists on standing when a man would like to sit. He does not let scores do the lying we like them to do, caress what should be cut. He learned from radio to trust a voice. Ullmann's off-camera monologue in Persona, a letter read in Winter Light, the priest's diary in Diary of a Country Priest, not his film but a grammar he brought into his own, a voice that must not be decorated because the truth is not improved by garnish. The face is his instrument, the hand is his metronome. He knows how to place a palm on a table and let a confession balance on it. He blocks like a stage director, yes, but he edits like a surgeon. Ola Rai and others cut scenes so that a word arrives a beat earlier than comfort and a caress a beat later. A cut is a refusal to lie about how suddenly a thought can interrupt an afternoon. The rhythm he finds in Fanny and Alexander, the late film that looks like a summing up and then turns into a midsummer feast, might be his most generous tempo, Christmas at a grandmother's house with the entire art of acting present, a theater company whose make-believe is an apprenticeship in truth, then an austere bishop's house where objects punish and the oppressive father figure of his childhood returns in a black cassock. The film believes that imaginations can defend children and that love needs rituals and rooms, lamps, tablecloths, a curtain. It is significantly full for a director famous for stripping away. There is no contradiction. He learned early that austerity and abundance are each other's remedies. When austerity becomes cruelty, abundance must return with plates. When abundance becomes distraction, austerity must close the door. He wrote like a working man. The magic lantern and images are not valedictories. They are toolkits and diaries. He trusted memory while insulting its reliability. He refused to romanticize his cruelty. He enumerated his failings like a bookkeeper and then asked forgiveness in the form of work. He was hard on himself and, when he was young, hard on others. Actors stayed because he changed. He changed because he could not bear to make the same scene without learning a new way to be present. Directors who learned from him took different parts of the craft. The patience for faces, the audacity to break a film and show the break, the permission to return to TV when film length will not hold a life, the courage to trust two people talking as enough for an evening. He taught the industry, not by memo but by example, that control is not the opposite of discovery, it is the condition under which discovery will be dignified. Bergman gave organizations a vocabulary without intending to. A meeting where someone admits a small truth, a retreat that is not a vacation but a workshop, a ritual of apology that is witnessed and sincere, a schedule that protects rehearsal, a space where silence is not negligence but practice. These are Bergman's gifts if we choose to claim them. He shows you how to stage a conversation so that dignity has room. Sit across from someone and lower the lighting and keep the camera of attention steady. That is how a confession becomes useful. He shows you how to use a series rather than a memo for a long problem. Scenes from a marriage is good governance applied to the domestic state. He shows you how an institution, a theater company, a family, a church, can become an instrument of harm or of repair depending on how rooms are lit and how authority speaks. He gives you the courage to rehearse a difficult moment until it is honest. He is not above error. He hurt people. He fled. He sulked. He raged. He made a country watch his tax case as if it were a morality play. He returned. He did not pretend the exile had improved him. The films register his vanity and then correct it. To watch them chronologically is to watch a man educate his own power. Early dominations become later invitations. Early severity becomes later patience. Early pride remains, chastened, and turned into craft. Late, when hands shook and the island sunlight sneaked through curtains, he made saraband out of two chairs and a camera and the rope that had been binding two people for a lifetime. He showed, calmly, that there is no substitute for the discipline of sitting and speaking plainly and listening well. What is the kit you can carry out of his studio? Begin with the face, protect it. When you are tempted to decorate a moment, remove something instead. When you think you need music, ask whether you need courage. When you are preparing a team for a difficult conversation, light the room in a way that honors the subject and refuses glamour. Rehearse. Not to script emotion but to agree on a rhythm that will protect the people involved. Give people time to say the one more sentence they were about to swallow. Let silence carry weight. Do not be afraid of rooms where God does not answer. Be afraid of rooms where nobody asks. If you have authority, spend it on rehearsal, on trust that returns as precision, on calendars that leave room for afternoons where the work is not deliverables but attention. He made a country's conscience audible and a world's intimacy visible. He coaxed actors into courage by giving them a camera that would not betray them. He made a thin light look like truth and left ugliness on the cutting room floor not because it was ugly but because it lied. He built a century's worth of therapy sessions we could all afford to attend. He changed how we see the world by insisting that the world enters us through faces and that faces are small continents we have no right to colonize, only to visit with respect. If you have ever sat across from a friend and known that the next sentence would decide the next year, you have already lived in his cinema. He gives you the craft to make that living less clumsy. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World.